The Defense Department published its first ever joint doctrine for military operations in cyberspace about a year and a half ago. But the document was kept secret. Now the Pentagon has released a declassified version. Much of it repeats what DoD officials have said in public, but there are some eyebrow raisers. Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu writes about it in this week's Inside the Reporter's Notebook.
It's just kind of a continuation of this idea that we need to formalize and institutionalize cyber as a discipline within the military and kind of make it look like the way that we think about every other sort of doctrine and every other type of domain that the military operates in. As you kind of indicated, you know, it's not as though DoD didn't have joint cyber doctrine in the past, but as the Government Accountability Office pointed out a couple years ago, it was kind of scattered in 16 different joint publications and dozens of other documents that were specific to the individual military services. What this document, which is called Joint Publication 3-12, does is pull that all together and operationalize cyber sort of in the same joint lexicon that, you know, military leaders are used to thinking about, you know, every other discipline in the military. It was a secret document up until last week, actually. It was first published in a secret format in March of last year. What we don't know is what was sort of taken out of the secret version in order to make this unclassified version. It's not like there are secret sections that are redacted and blacked out. It's just basically a rewritten document. So what I think you see is a lot of the stuff that pertains to defensive cyber operations and network operations are still intact. And there's comparatively little about offensive cyber operations that are mentioned in at least this classified or this unclassified version of the document anyway. However, they are still referenced. There's still definitely an acknowledgement that the military has offensive cyber capabilities. It's, of course, not the first time the military has made that acknowledgement, but it puts that in black and white. The other main thing I think it does, besides, again, institutionalizing cyber, is it really is a good reference for exactly who is supposed to do what within this whole cyber structure within DoD. It tells you exactly, for example, what the Defense Information Systems Agency's role is. It gives a pretty detailed roadmap on how DoD plans to, from a joint perspective, sort of command and control its cyber forces. It tells you exactly what the role of U.S. Cyber Command is when it details forces that it's built out to the individual combatant commands and then up the chain, the relationship with U.S. Strategic Command. So for people who are trying to understand how DoD thinks about cyber and how it's trying to operationalize cyber, I think at the very least for that purpose, it's a very good reference document, even if there aren't a whole lot of surprises from a policy perspective in the document itself, although there were a few that I picked out.
It seems like you can tell as much about this document from what it leaves out as opposed to what it puts in. For example, you said that it refers to the offensive cyber operations, but doesn't come right out and define them. Is that something that you think is probably in that secret document that was first released a year and a half ago?
That's my strong suspicion. I would say there's probably a lot more detail about offensive cyber operations in the classified version of this document. But again, it's not as though they're not referenced at all. They're just kind of talked about a little bit more obliquely without a whole lot of detail into exactly, you know, what capabilities DoD has and how it would, you know, employ them. There are some surprises in the document, I think you would have to say. That one of them is that DoD cyber officials, when they talk about the way that they're going to defend the network, which is what they talk about most in public because it's probably the least sensitive topic in this whole area of cyber warfare, they usually describe it as sort of this passive response. If someone's attacking our networks, you know, we're going to engage in all these countermeasures to make sure they don't get into something serious. We're going to wall off the network to make sure they don't get into really sensitive systems. This document really makes clear that there are, at least in certain circumstances, the department feels that there are standing rules of engagement that would allow them to basically, aggressively attack the attacker and shut down the attack essentially at its source rather than just, you know, doing a passive defense of your own networks. Another thing that I did want to highlight is the Joint Pub 3-12 does, it basically reiterates what has been the U.S. government's consistent position for years, which is that when it comes to defending the .gov and .com networks in the U.S., in other words, you know, privately owned critical infrastructure and, you know, non-defense systems within the government, DHS has the lead role for that. And this document reiterates that. But in without really defining exactly what officials mean, again, in this unclassified version, they say that there are, again, standing authorities that would basically allow DOD to subsume DHS's authority. The quote is, DOD's missions could take primacy over and subsume the standing missions of other departments or agencies. Again, doesn't define exactly in what circumstances that would occur or you know, where those authorities are derived from in law. But that was a little bit of an eyebrow raiser, I thought.
Yeah, interesting to contemplate the possibilities that could be included in that. Moving on, you write about a lot more in your reporter's notebook that's at federalnewsradio.com. We're not going to get a chance to talk about all of it, of course, but I did want to ask you about the moves made towards rapid acquisition in the DOD. It seems like they're trying to institutionalize that.
Yeah, we talked about this with Andrew Hunter, who's been the director of the Joint Rapid Acquisition Cell for the past 2 years. He's now leaving for a job at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The case study that everyone always points to when it comes to rapid acquisition in DOD as the success story is the Mine-Resistant Ambush Protected Vehicles Project, MRAPs. And yeah, it did indeed get a lot of capability out to the field very quickly. But in order for that to happen, you had to have the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates at the time, basically personally bird-dogging that every single day. And that's really not ideal. I think basically everyone agrees. What the department's been trying to do ever since then is, as you said, institutionalize this process, build it into the muscle memory of the acquisition system so that when there's a validated joint requirement that needs to get turned out quickly, the system just responds and it just goes. So Hunter feels like they've made a lot of gains in that area. But as we pointed out during the roundtable last week, a lot of this is just culture. He says one of the things that he thinks has gone some way toward inculcating that is a new annex that DOD added last year to what's called DOD Instruction 5000.02, which is kind of the main acquisition guidebook for all of DOD. And here's a little bit of what he had to say about the impact that he thinks that will have made.
It can't lock in the progress that we've achieved, but I think it lets everyone know that it's okay to keep doing this. You know, this wasn't just a one-time thing. So I would say if you go back to 2002, 2003, there were a lot of questions, including within the acquisition community, say, you know, can we really do this? Can we really deliver things inside of a year? Is our system capable of it? You know, the budget process. I mean, there were a lot of hurdles, the requirements process. I mean, there's a lot of hurdles that people said, you know, it just can't do it. You know, the government system will never achieve that. And we proved that we can achieve it. So I think one of the biggest things is, you know, if you will, just kind of that self-knowledge that the workforce, I think, has now to say, this can be done. You know, this is not something that is impossible to do. Our system will allow us to do this. And so I think the message of the enclosure really is not only was it okay then, it's okay now. It's not only okay, it's expected. This is what our expectation is that we're going to behave this way for things that are urgent operational needs.
So time will tell. I mean, probably what you need is for, you know, a few big projects to happen, you know, beyond MRAPs that people can point back to. So this whole idea of rapid acquisition can, you know, build up constituency and you know, build up, as I said, muscle memory within the system. The one big success story since MRAPs that Hunter pointed to when he was actually on our air a couple weeks ago with Tom Temin was the whole project to destroy Syria's chemical weapons. That was an instance in which, you know, an Army capability came together with Navy capabilities. They were put together very quickly on board a civilian crewed military sea lift command ship, and they were able to, you know, within the span of a few months, bring those capabilities together and dispose of all those chemical weapons in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, really without much incident. So there's at least one good example there.
Yeah, and it seems like the Ebola response could provide another test case scenario for some innovative technology to get out to the field.
Yeah, it may. I think it remains to be seen how much technological development that's going to involve, since that operation is really just spinning up right now. But you're right; it may offer some opportunities there.
Yeah. And very briefly, Jared, the Pentagon is trying another tactic to save money in terms of cutting travel expenses. Can you just explain what people working for DOD are seeing now?
Yeah, there's a few of them. Let me just focus on one in the limited time that we have. But DOD is basically turning to credit card rebates as one way to offset its cuts during sequestration. So one policy change that the military services are individually making right now is they're telling both military personnel and civilians that when they make what's called a permanent change of station, move from one duty station to another in another part of the country, they're required to use their government-issued travel cards for all their incidental expenses, as opposed to using their own personal cards and seeking reimbursement. They're kind of framing it as a benefit to DOD personnel because, you know, they're not risking getting behind on their own credit cards. They're not having to go and submit receipts and everything so that they can get reimbursed after the fact. But it definitely has benefits for the Defense Department as well. If they can boost the amount of money that they're spending through that government travel card program by just 5%, then they'll start getting rebates of up to 11% from their credit card vendor, just the same way, you know, you and I might get, you know, miles or cashback rebates from our own personal credit cards. But this is not an optional policy. It's something that, as the military services roll them out, is going to be required for all those PCS moves going forward. The Army and the Air Force have already made that policy change. The Marine Corps is expected to do so very soon. And I think the Navy is running a pilot that they also expect to turn into a permanent policy pretty quickly here.